Hi, vlogging heads. This is Spencer Ackerman, the Washington Independent Newsroom, with my good friend Eli Lake of the Washington Times. Everyone knows Eli Lake not just for being an excellent national security reporter, but for the simple fact, as people know from his distinguished career and biography, that he lives a thug life like Doug Fife, the ultimate neocon phenomenon. And I have to say, after looking at some stuff that's occurred at CPAC, people are biting your style, Eli, and wow. I want to give you a chance to respond to what's going on in these streets.
Well, I mean, it's funny you say that, because I saw High Caliber in that Blumenthal video.
Let's explain what's going on.
Okay, first of all, High Caliber is a construction worker from New Jersey who spits hot fire. And I was unaware of this guy. He's a conservative rapper, but I think he just changed hip-hop. How about that?
That's blowing my mind. I mean...
Yeah, I mean, it's really good, and we're going to include a link to Blumenthal, and we're going to include a link to High Caliber, but I need to collab with this guy, because when I heard him, I was like, oh my God, that's... I mean, to be honest with you, I mean, I think I'm pretty good as a rapper, but that's what I'm going for. You know what I'm saying?
I have to admit I'm surprised by this, because I thought you were going to be realer here. Because, you know, people are out there, you know, like they said about Jeezy, biting your style, biting your ad-libs, taking the essence of what you do and making it about, you know, bullshit like a border fence. And
well,
High
Caliber and I do not line up on a lot of issues, but I'm saying verbally, verbally, he's iller than an AIDS patient, to quote... Nas. I mean, he's sick. I can't even tell you. I mean, like, he's just got a real gift at it, and I thought his beats were really great. I thought that Mr. Conservative, he incorporates all the taglines from talk radio.
Notice how he flipped PC. He said he's a PC, a positive conservative.
Right.
And
like
that I thought,
Jersey kid.
That I thought, holy, you know, this... This is
I
this
like
is
if,
next
if you're
level
not
stuff.
Certain the search is working. I thought that was a nice line too. I was like, I heard it for the first time, and I said, you know, listen, you know what? Let me just. Spencer and I have collaborated on some hip hop, so we should say that, right?
We have, yes.
Okay, we did the Dano Blago rap.
The original
Dano Blago, right? Which I'm the first time I was only credited as Vitamin on that rap, but we'll
now it can be told.
Now it can be told that that was me. I'm the second verse. Spencer is very hot in a Rick Ross-like style on the first verse, which when I read the food post that you did on Rick Ross, which was hilarious, I thought it was interesting because it was kind of going for that Rick Ross style. But
it definitely was, and now I'm kind of rethinking it, because here's the thing about that.
Right.
Notice how when High Caliber talks about how he's a positive conservative, a lifelong Jersey kid, he got his education from the streets
just like
Curtis
did. I know.
That, of course,
so ill.
That, of course, is a reference to Curtis Jackson, 50 Cent, the one and only, who's currently engaged in probably hip-hop's most entertaining and potentially combustible feud.
Yes.
The Rick Ross 50 Cent feud is something really unbelievable.
If Rick Ross was to combust, it would be like the final scene of the Monty Python's Meeting of Life, or not seeing
totally.
In the restaurant
Mr.
with
Crazy
the guy, because as you I think pointed out, which was hilarious, that Rick Ross video is just all about him eating stuff. Like he's eating grapes, he's eating cheese. We'll post a link to that too.
Rick Ross, for the uninitiated, you might call a Rubenesque individual.
Yes, he is.
He's
well rounded,
Jabba-like. You would think.
With the heavy set.
We might as well, you know, say at this point, if High Caliber, you know, if you're watching, the question is what beef you want with either of us.
No, I don't want to be. I want to collab with him.
You want to collaborate. Okay.
Let me explain. If High Caliber, if you're watching, I want you to think about this. I'd love to do a piece with you, which I think would be much more appropriate if I did it with High Caliber. And I've already got the title. It's called Mike Steele in the Hour of Chaos.
That's right.
And it's about Mike Steele breaking out high-level Bush administration officials from the International Criminal Court in The Hague in a kind of commando-like operation. But I want to do it as a narrative. I don't want to, like, you know, talk about it like normal. I want to, like, actually have it, you know, a scene-by-scene sort of thing. You know, I figured Kofor Black would be involved. You know, John McCain obviously has a lot of experience with that.
Not sure he's up for this operation.
Yeah, I know. John McCain could maybe be, like, just doing the op room, doing, you know, playing point or something like that. But the idea would be, like, you know, just you'd have, like, the, you know, busting out, like, Condoleezza from the ICC or something.
Well, let me ask you this on actually the question of conservatives and hip-hop.
Yeah.
A couple days ago, my friend Adam Serwer at the American Prospect was kind of doing some semiotic analysis.
As he often does. By the way, Adam Serwer said that Marty Peretz was like Malcolm X, and ever since then, I have referred to Marty Peretz as my personal Malcolm X.
I call him Malcolm Little myself.
He's my Malcolm X. All right, but let's go. Let's move on that. We're not gonna talk Marty Peretz right now. But okay.
So what I wanted to get off that was, Adam took a reading of the way Barack Obama and the way Mike Steele use slang, and what he emerged from it is basically that Mike Steele is doing this as a way of making himself appealing and non-threatening to white people, as opposed to trying to actually connect with a black audience. And I'm wondering, as you know, we're seeing with High Caliber at CPAC, the rise of this sort of dialogue in conservative circles. Do you think that basically this is just simply a kind of pose for white people to amuse themselves? Or do you think there's something more significant and culturally totemic at work?
Listen, there's no way that you can separate hip-hop from the African-American experience, particularly starting in, like, 1981, whenever you want to start it, maybe in the 70s. And it is, in that sense, you say, a black American medium, but hip-hop is also a very unique form of music and way of expressing yourself, and it's a wonderful way of looking at language. And as somebody who skews to the center-right, I've always felt that voices that were more conservative in hip-hop have always been lacking, even though I thought socioeconomically that there was an argument to be made that actually rappers were conservative in certain respects, certainly in tax bracket sense, and certainly in a kind of adherence to, you know, a raw capitalism and a justification of capitalism, one could even say in terms of conspicuous consumption. So I'm happy about High Caliber, not from the perspective of, the Republican Party, the conservative movement, which is actually not something that is, like, a major issue for me, but rather just as a lifelong fan of hip-hop and somebody who'd like to consider, you know, I guess in the way of a member of the hip-hop community, that finally there's this guy who is an effective, brilliant rapper who is giving a conservative point of view in this medium that has been lacking it. You follow what I'm saying with that?
I do. What's interesting about that is the examples that you gave, and I think the examples that do exist in hip-hop, are sort of indications of conservatism along a more, you know, social and economic perspective. And you don't fit into either of that with your conservatism. So I'm wondering, like, where you think
neoconservatism has been particularly not represented in hip-hop.
Yeah, there's no one with that flag. That's you. That's your space.
Well, but now maybe High Caliber. So it's me and High Caliber. No, I mean, listen, I think that my point is more a really basic one, and it's not even that great a point. It's just that hip-hop is itself a wonderful medium, and as it matures as a medium, it's great to see any kind of perspective, you know, coming. We shouldn't be surprised. There's French rappers, there's Cameroon rappers, there's rappers who talk about, you know, all kinds of experience, and more
Shanghai,
people.
Shanghai, big hip-hop scene there.
Yeah, there you go. Right, exactly. So hip-hop is something that can accommodate. It's just now it's a form. So it obviously takes skills. My view of it is simply that, like, anybody, I mean, I shouldn't be in particular, like, you know, but I'm not going to get identity politics about it. You know, I just, you know, it's, I think that it shows the maturity of hip-hop that a guy like High Caliber is out there doing what he's doing right now.
What's interesting about, you know, we just talked about the different hip-hop scenes around. I've been getting some indications that some of the Shanghai rap scene, prominent members of the Shanghai rap scene, have financial ties to a former U.S. ambassador from Saudi Arabia named Chaz Freeman.
Nice transition.
Who's been someone that you've been writing about, particularly today. You had quite a scoop about him. Why don't you go on about what's going on with Chaz Freeman? What's the importance of it? Who is this guy? Why are we paying attention to him right now?
Yeah, well, before we started, I read your post in the Washington Independent, and you raised some interesting points, which I'm sure you're going to articulate, but one of the things you said is you didn't think it was a very important post. The National Intelligence Council is, as we both know, the Supreme Court of the intelligence community. And so I think that that is a fairly important. Maybe it's because where you sit is where you stand. I tend to cover the intelligence community, but the NIC chairman, or the National Intelligence Council chairman, is the guy who is going to forge the consensus of what we know to be true as the basis of national security decisions. And as we know, that's a pretty powerful job. Now,
well, it has become more of a backwater in recent years. I think that's fair to say.
Well, it depends on the president, too.
I mean, you quoted Robert Hutchings, and I promise you, viewers, we're going to get back to Friedman in 1 second. He'll be one of the first people to tell you that in recent years the position's been gelded, that the national intelligence officers on the council have grown in influence, and that long-term analysis, which is really what the NIC is supposed to do more than forge consensus on certain issues.
Well, they write the NIEs.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
This is where I'm going. The national intelligence officers who actually do write those NIEs have become more powerful as long-term intelligence.
Oh, than the actual
analysis.
Chairman.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, that's a fair point.
That's the only point I wanted to make on that. But go into who Friedman is.
Well, Friedman's a former ambassador of Saudi Arabia. He was Henry Kissinger's translator in the breakthrough back channel talks that led to diplomatic recognition of China, mainland China. He's probably one of the best Mandarin speakers in the Foreign Service, who went through the Foreign Service. He's former Assistant Secretary of Defense, a real establishment guy. Since he has been out of power, and I didn't get as much into this as others, I mean, he's embraced the Walt Mearsheimer thesis about the Israel lobby and has taken views that are really chafing, I think, to a lot of folks in what might be called, for lack of a better word, the pro-Israel community. So that's one part of it. But then he's also taken a number of jobs.
I want to appropriate that pro-Israel term.
Right. Well, we can talk about that, too.
Bracket that for a moment.
But the other thing that I thought was more interesting was that, you know, his Middle East Policy Council has received funding, at least $1 million for Prince Tal Walid, the Saudi royal who money was famously refused after 9/11 by Rudy Giuliani. But then there's these anonymous donors worth in 2006 in his tax returns that are going to be investigated that they won't disclose. So it's at least, as I say right now, at least $1 million. It looks like a lot of its endowment comes from the Saudi royal family. Chaz Friedman has said as much himself in interviews with, a Saudi-U.S. relations interview. And then he's also on the International Advisory Board of the Chinese National Offshore Oil Corporation, which, you know, does business all over the world and, is majority owned by the Chinese government. So is there
evidence that Friedman himself has been bought? Is that what we're talking about here?
Well, I mean, I cannot say whether things that Friedman says or things that Friedman does are because foreign governments are paying him to do so. I would only make this point a fairly subtle one, I think, for those self-appointed defenders of the national interest who have complained about the influence of an Israel lobby, it is ironic, to say the least, that they would come to the defense of someone who is literally in the pay of two foreign governments as a sort of antidote to that. So, I mean, my question is, Are you?
Well, except that we don't know that he's in the pay, right?
Yes, we do know he's in the pay. He received $87,000 in 2006 from the Middle East Policy Council, an organization which has received most of its endowment from one Saudi prince, at the very least. He's thanked King Abdullah, or what time was Crown Prince Abdullah, for, these very generous gifts and so forth. So, and we also know that he's on the International Advisory Board of CNOOC. It's quite possible that he's advising the Chinese National Oil Company out of the goodness of his heart, but I would imagine he probably also draws a check from them. And this says nothing of his consulting firm, Projects International, similar to a Kissinger and Associates or an Armitage and Associates, that is essentially there to, you know, open markets in foreign countries to international corporations, that works on sort of both sides of that. So these kinds of connections are fine. When you leave government, you want to go into that, that's all fine. But when you go back in, most good government types say that that is evidence of a kind of revolving door, and it's usually something that people are on the lookout for, particularly the Obama administration, which has gone out of its way to sort of have these very, very stringent ethics rules for senior government officials.
Well, but, you know, why then haven't we seen the kind of outrage among the pro-Israel community, and I'm kind of building the answer to the question about, you know, someone like Bill Lynn, who is basically the Obama administration's deputy secretary of defense, who was a Raytheon lobbyist. He was Raytheon's top lobbyist. He is now the number two person in the Department of Defense. One of the things the Obama administration talked about yesterday that I've been writing about is a whole lot about defense contractor reform. It's curious because it seems like there you have much more of a direct conflict of interest, but we're not seeing the same kind of outrage from the same circle. So, let's just unpack it. Like, what exactly, you know, isn't the beef here really just about Friedman's views about Israel?
No, I think that that's a red herring. I mean, listen, if this had been the Bush administration and he'd appointed somebody who was on the International Advisory Board of CNOOC, the Chinese National Oil Company, we would hear a lot, and I think rightfully we'd hear a lot from, you know, the net left. Hold on just 1 second.
Who's the letter to?
12 Democrats and Republicans.
12 Democrats and Republicans.
Yes. Everybody, that's Barbara Slavin, my assistant managing editor. Anyway, that's the...
Notice, by the way.
That was weird. She's asking me a question about a web story that's about to go up. But my point here is that, yes, Raytheon's an American company. These are foreign governments who are paying this guy, and he's going to be in charge of these incredibly important estimates. Maybe he'll recuse himself from everything having to do with China and all the other implications of that, but that would leave him very little role as a NIC chairman.
So basically, would it be the goal of the people who are trying to... Actually, what is the goal? Is it to get rid of Friedman?
I don't know that there's... I mean, I wouldn't frame it that way. The Inspector General was asked by 12 members of Congress to examine his ties to Saudi Arabia. He's doing that right now. I have actually the letter when this goes up, and we can link to the story, my follow-up, of him saying we will examine those ties. We know from my story that the White House has yet to do what's called a spin or a special investigation led by the FBI. Freeman's yet to put in his financial disclosures for this. And, you know, my understanding is that his vetting for the security clearances that he would need is not even completed yet. And when you are working, when you've received money from foreign corporations, whether as a consultant, as an advisor, or in his capacity as the president of the Middle East Policy Council, that is going to raise issues in the vetting process for something this sensitive, dealing with intelligence, particularly intelligence on foreign countries.
But, I mean, a lot of this basically emerged from basically right-wing, in their estimation, pro-Israel lobbyists.
Well, those are the first people who criticized the pick of Freeman to chair the National Intelligence Council.
They've also been like shopping.
Sort of moved on.
Well, they've also been shopping the OPPO research around about.
Well, I mean, what
I'm asking is, like, is the goal to geld Friedman or is it to get him out of the position? I mean, like, a lot of the blogging about him has been about, you know, when's Obama going to dump him?
You know, I can tell you only for myself that I was not given any opposition research from AIPAC, okay? I can tell you that I reported this story on my own and talked to numerous peoples. I think I talked to 25 people for this story that I just wrote that's out today.
Which, interestingly enough, several of the people you like quote, so we're not getting a twisted picture here, are pro-Friedman. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I interviewed 3 former chairmen of the NIC, one former vice chairman of the NIC. I got one of the great China hands in the story. We have all kinds of people in the story. You know, some of them defending Friedman, some of them are not defending Friedman.
The argument against Friedman isn't an argument that he would make a poor NIC chairman. It's that, meaning he's not qualified for the position. It's that he's potentially compromised.
I think that would be the argument from people who would have read my piece and then blogged about it. I would also point out that I quote Tom Malinowski, who is the Washington Advocacy Director of Human Rights Watch, saying that he's uncomfortable with Friedman as well. I mean, there's human rights grounds against him. And there's an email, which I was not able to confirm, sadly, that he gave to some private listserv. By the way, that's Sarah Carter in the background of the Washington Times. She's now waving and so forth.
The blue hat you see is our congressional correspondent, Mike Lewis. And
this is so cool.
I think Dave Weigel has just actually stepped out from behind me. But,
Did you see this, what he said about Tiananmen Square, Spencer?
It seemed like he was justifying the massacre at Tiananmen Square.
I think what he was saying was that the Chinese authorities should have done this sooner and that most governments would not have tolerated such civil disobedience in their capital. But the words that he chooses are so harsh, and he sort of justifies it as a Burkean conservative. And, you know, that I think got a lot of attention. Certainly John Chait's attention. And then, you know, Stephen Walt, who, you know, of course wrote the lobby book, which I'm not particularly a fan of, and, you know, he started attacking people, and it was unbelievable. It's like he only named these Jews who are going after Friedman because it must be the lobby. And I kept saying to myself, well, aren't you concerned that this guy's received, you know, as, you know, financially linked to 2 foreign governments? I mean, that's a real, you know, foreign lobby. So, anyway.
Well, let's move on from Freeman.
Okay.
The other big thing that's, I think it's fair to say, going on now, probably, you know, actually, you don't mind the insult, which I don't mean to be an insult, sorry, that was a poor choice of words, you know, rather larger than Freeman, is the current review of strategy for Afghanistan and Pakistan.
Did you coin AFPAC or did they coin AFPAC?
Oh, they coined AFPAC. They've just been...
Can I recommend a better, even better than AFPAC?
What's that?
Al-Qaeda-stan. Think about it, right? We're talking about the area that's in part Afghanistan, part Pakistan, that's controlled by Al-Qaeda.
But you don't have... That gets you, like, part of Pakistan. It doesn't really get you... Parts of Afghanistan, I guess you could call Talibanistan.
But
anyway.
Or Taliban, Al-Qaeda, or something like that. But I'm just saying that the issue is that, like, there's this area between the two countries where they don't recognize there's a border, and it's something like this ascetic Sharia... Mm-hmm. Bin Laden-y state, and you know that's our big issue.
You know, this is probably the largest issue in American foreign policy right now.
I would agree with that. Yes.
And one of the things that's been kind of conspicuous to me, as I've been writing about a kind of meta debate about it, and we can, if you'd like, you know, talk about some stuff that I've been writing about for AFPAC. But one of the interesting things that I saw is that. Where the cleavages over Afghanistan seem to exist, they seem to exist entirely on the left. That there's a battle between the administration and its more, I guess fair to say, like, war on terror-centric, even though they probably not use that term, security allies, some of whom are, in fact, very progressive, and some further progressive folks, who are part of an organization sort of loosely defined called Get Afghanistan Right, that are trying to, that argue against the plus up in Afghanistan and are kind of like coming out with further positions about what an alternative Afghanistan policy might be, basically an Afghanistan policy without an Afghanistan war. And what I haven't been seeing so much, and you can, you know, tell me if this is wrong, you know, from the speech that John McCain made, there was something at AEI I think it was last week with Tom Donnelly and Fred Kagan. There hasn't been so much of a kind of concurrent debate on the right. You know, Corey Shockey wrote on Shadow Government, one of Foreign Policy's really excellent blogs. Probably the furthest rightward and strident argument against a plus up of troops in Afghanistan. My question to you is: Are you seeing the same sort of thing that positions on the right haven't really coalesced about Afghanistan?
Spencer, I don't know if you've noticed, but the right's really not in power. So I think that, like, you know.
Well, we talked about what.
I know what you're saying, but I'm saying that, like, I think though that it's what's interesting is that the left has a chance to really influence a lot of national security issues with the Obama administration. Obviously, I mean, to give one example, you know, when John Brennan, you know. Sort of has bounced out of the DCI, that was largely because there was a really big concern in, you know, from Glenn Greenwald and other groups that, you know, I guess I would sort of, you know, the pro-civil liberties groups, and they have to pay attention to that. I think that the absence of the, you know, influence of the conservatives at this point is, as evidence of the last election and sort of the government now, that it means that, you know, the urgency of coming up with, you know, kind of, you know, the exact right policy is really not there in the way it was in 2006, 2007 with Surge. Because it's just, it's not to say that, I mean, I think that the general sense is that, yes, you should stay in Afghanistan, you should try to get it right. But I don't have, you know, and part of it, I mean, I'm just only speaking for myself here, Spencer, but unless you got to do a lot of other things just in give more troops to Afghanistan. Wouldn't you agree with that? I mean, it's obvious.
I would definitely agree with that.
Yeah,
what's more, that's a consensus position.
Yeah, it is a consensus position. I'm curious, actually, maybe you can explain. You've been writing a lot about this, and, of course, I've been reading it. Tell me a little bit about sort of how the objection goes, because I remember that the argument for withdrawing from Iraq was predicated on because we want to go to the right war where Al-Qaeda really is, which is Afghanistan.
Right.
So... It seems that, you know, okay, now that's what we're doing. You know, I mean, we've got the withdrawal of combat troops and so forth, and there's a plus up in Afghanistan, and then you've got these folks. I mean, are they backing away from their earlier position?
Well, it depends on sort of
creating
a taxonomy of who is actually saying this.
Yeah,
I think it's fair to say the mainstream Democratic position throughout the last 4 years, probably starting around the 2004 election, was that, as you say, they use Afghanistan probably, you know, as a cudgel against the Iraq War, and a club at the against mm-hmm. the Bush administration, then an issue itself.
Yeah.
I think that's a function of the fact that it was better politics, national security-wise, to be able to say on the left that they weren't against all wars. They were, in fact, committed to a broader war against al-Qaeda, and the trouble with Iraq was that it was a distraction from that war. That kind of got you away from taking a more robust and thought-out position about what, in fact, should be done in Afghanistan.
Right.
And I think there the left is basically reaping the whirlwind of that lassitude.
Right.
On a broader sort of cultural point about, you know, where we are politically, you know, it's also the case that, mm-hmm. you know, as the left was using Afghanistan as an argument against the Iraq War rather than an issue itself, the right wasn't really paying much attention to it either. You know, it's sort of amazing that the current ambassador in Afghanistan, who most people can't even name, a guy named Ambassador Wood, you know, comes from Colombia. You know, he was basically a narco guy. He wasn't someone who was, you know, studying really versed in the region's politics the way that, you know, someone like Ryan Crocker, who was ambassador to Pakistan before he went to Iraq, you know, really was. So there you've got kind of a dilemma for the left. Now it's suddenly in power. The exception here has been Barack Obama, who spent the last 2 years saying, you know, rather specifically, like, not only if elected will I send more troops to Afghanistan, but I will have a greater...
I'll violate
Pakistan's sovereignty under specific conditions. And I had been writing throughout 2007 in a piece I did for The American Prospect in early 2008 that you really can't understand what Obama is talking about more broadly in the world without a sense of that. And this is something that I think, you know, my read on was that the left was kind of happy to indulge in a kind of cynical way,
mm-hmm.
and now it basically papered over a real discussion about what, in fact, people were willing to sign on for substantively in Afghanistan, and this is really where it's coming out of. One of the things that has been kind of interesting about where the debate is shaped is so many people from the Obama administration are coming in from the counterinsurgency community. People who are theorists and practitioners of counterinsurgency and real students of it, a lot of them in Afghanistan, in Pakistan.
Yeah.
The new Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Central Asia is a guy named Craig Mullaney, who was an Army captain in Afghanistan, served there. That's an interesting milestone in and of itself, and now you've got, you know, someone who is basically a company commander in Afghanistan is now in a real major policy position, and a lot of people with that kind mm-hmm. of experience who were around the Center for New American Security, probably the most, I think it's fair to say, important think tank in Washington right now.
Wow, that's an endorsement.
I think it's the only think tank that matters.
I like CNAS. As you know, I had that scoop about the CNAS Colin Call thing. Remember that?
That turned out very much
to be the plan, it seems.
Well, you know, and Colin, for instance, is now Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East. So,
source stuff is Spencer Ackerman right now at the Pentagon?
I'm enjoying it. It's fun.
No, reporter, I tease, and just for the viewer, reporters hate to talk about their sources. So, Spencer did the right thing there. Obviously, he's not going to get into it. But it is something, like, I like read Laura Rosen, and I say to myself, oh my God, Laura says source stuff at the State Department. And I read a Spencer, and I'm like, Spencer's pretty stressed up at the Pentagon right now.
What I guess I would say is, you know, when you are reporting, like, just pay real close attention to who's at the think tanks and who comes into the think tanks, because they're the next government.
Usually how it works.
The point being on Afghanistan and Pakistan, Obama has basically brought in a bunch of people who have rather thorough and I think it's fair to say, you know, rigorously thought out and debated ideas, not so much about Afghanistan and Pakistan specifically, but about how a kind of functioning counterinsurgency environment ought to work. And, you know, this is what happens when you're in the newsroom, people start calling you. So I apologize for the buzzing on the phone.
By the way, you missed it, but, like, the news meeting for the 4 o'clock news, front page news meeting was announced everywhere with, like, a big bell.
That's what that was.
4 o'clock news meeting.
All right,
front page.
All right, I don't know if you're doing budget lines or something.
No, I'm not. I'm not an editor. I can,
okay.
You know.
That's good.
By the way, Bill Gertz is in the background.
Oh, man.
The great Bill Gertz.
I've never actually seen Bill Gertz. I didn't know if he actually existed or if he was...
No, Bill Gertz exists.
But the point I just want to wrap up on is that where you're seeing this debate take place in the Obama administration is among people who think a whole lot about how to construct interagency dialogue and relationships between development communities, governance communities, and security communities as a component of implementing a national strategy. And the national strategy itself is to be determined. And that's something that have people on the left really concerned about, that are we putting resources in, as with the 17,000, really 23,000, when you add on the Army Brigade and the Marine Battalion from last year, into Afghanistan before there's actually a strategy here. One of the things that the Obama administration, you know, keeps on saying in background and off-the-record conversations is that, like, they really do want to come up with what the end game for Afghanistan and Pakistan looks like. And that's been something that I just wonder, you know, it's been pretty much verboten to think about and to talk about, to be a little bit dramatic, since 2001, that the idea really was, under the Bush administration, that there was just this kind of open-ended commitment, and no one really gave much effort on the left or on the right or in the administration or outside the administration toward what a kind of end game would look like. What would the future of Afghanistan look like if perhaps there was no war? Last week, a whole bunch of Afghan government officials came to Washington to share their thoughts with the administration, and they held a briefing for some of us in the press. And I asked, you know, how do you think this war ends? What does it look like? And all of them said something that I think it's fair to say a year ago would have been absolutely mind-blowing in Washington, which is, we think it ends with a negotiated settlement with basically the mid-tiers, which is the fat part of the bell curve of the insurgency in Afghanistan. No one who's affiliated with al-Qaeda, or as they put it, committed crimes against humanity or rejects the Afghan constitution can be dealt with, they believe. And the foot soldiers are basically people you just need to give economic incentives to.
I would say that a year ago that would have been that would have been okay in this town, because that was the strategy in Iraq. I mean, that was the same concept.
Well, except that it wasn't really. I mean, what's interesting about that is that was a strategy that kind of evolved by practitioners more than it emanated from the White House. That, you know, the first instances of real large-scale negotiations with Sunni insurgents in Iraq, you know, come out of commanders in Anbar province, not as a kind of national strategy, and certainly not as a strategy from the Iraqi government, who pretty much...
Well, Casey was oblivious to all this when a lot of these things started and tried to stop it, much to, you know, I mean, Casey will not go down as a very good general.
But what's interesting along that point is this is kind of the opposite. This is the Afghan government, and there's an important debate, you know, about whether this is actually a position of weakness from the Afghan government or actually a kind of broadly thought-out strategy for how this goes. But what's interesting about it is with the rise of the counterinsurgency community, you know, taking for the first time positions of policymaking, you know, high-level policymaking, it carries with it the implication of, you know, why not look at how pretty much every insurgency, you know, ends when counterinsurgency is ultimately for a kind of blended term, successful. And it ends with co-optation and negotiation rather than either a clear-cut military victory or a clear-cut military defeat from either side. Usually there's co-optation here. And one wonders,
well,
you know...
co-optation to defeat the leadership and hardline elements of the enemy.
Right, but the question is when you talk about, you know, defeating that leadership, sometimes the leadership, you know, it happens in you know, the Philippines quite a lot. Basically, the leadership decides we'd rather just like a position in government rather than saying, you know, all of a sudden all my dudes are gone.
By the way, I mean, it's obviously case by case, but when the leadership of an insurgency group says we'd like to be part of the government, but if then use their position in the government, as Sadr did in 2005 and 2006, to further their maximalist and violent aims, then you have to get them out of the government.
Or perhaps maybe a different way of putting it is, the prospect of an insurgency continuing when insurgents find themselves inside the government is a real one. That basically, you know, there's a question of what's co-optation and what's infiltration.
Right.
And that's something that's got to be addressed from an Afghan perspective. But it was just very interesting to see.
Can I pick a bone, though, on this one point? Okay. I have heard this, not from you, Spencer, okay, but from others that, like, when people say, oh, it, you know, what happened in Iraq? We just paid off a bunch of, you know, our former enemies. And, you know, some of that's basically in some ways right, but it sort of misses the point. But that seems to be, like, a really important principle in counterinsurgency, and it's not something to be dismissed, and that when Obama is now going to try this strategy in earnest in Afghanistan, you know, I would certainly think that conservatives would not dismiss it as, oh, we just paid off a bunch of guys. I mean, it's good to do that. If you pay them off and they stop killing people, fabulous.
Well, it's also, I mean, also I'm actually going to go further than you. In many cases, it actually wasn't correct, or rather, it wasn't sufficiently correct.
Right, there's other
what you would probably better want to do is ask, well, which insurgents did you pay off?
Yeah, that's
exactly
right.
You didn't pay off, well, first of all, just on the question, like, you didn't pay off the, you know, what Petraeus likes to call the irreconcilables.
Right.
But more importantly, the people you didn't pay off, they weren't insurgent leaders. You know, what you gave to you know, the leaders of the tribes in Anbar and then in the southern part of Baghdad was the prospect of political power. Now, that comes with, you know, an accordant amount of economic power.
Right.
But it just wasn't the case. I mean, you paid off a lot of their men.
Right.
And you gave positions to a lot of their men. You know, sometimes to be a little bit less euphemistic, you sort of look the other way when they decided they were just going to take over certain parts of territory.
Yeah.
And you
brought in some, like, former Ba'athist groups that did some nasty things. There,
right.
there were some
but the
people
point,
in the crossfire of all that who are not quite irreconcilable, but pretty awful. I mean, I keep going back to a guy named Khalif Al-Ayyan, you know, that you try to work with, though he didn't end up actually working. I mean, he's somebody who actually didn't end up kind of keeping his side of the bargain, but there are people who you bring in part because, you know that they've done some bad things, and it's a judgment call. That's the point. It's a judgment
right.
call, but it's not as simple as you just paid everybody who was shooting at you to stop shooting at you.
And what's interesting also, what's going to be interesting about the way this shapes up is you find yourself looking over the border into Pakistan and just seeing horrible option after horrible option. And
This is an important point that you, I think, make your point. This is good.
The point I want to make about Pakistan, we sort of touched on this in one of the previous ones we did.
Yeah.
Right now you find yourself in a really terrifying situation where when Obama gave his first press conference, he described conditions of success in Afghanistan as basically being the eradication of safe havens in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And what happened over the last 2 weeks is basically the Taliban won a war in the Swat Valley for control of this place. The Pakistani government decided whether you want to call it a retrenchment, whether you want to call it a ceasefire,
mm-hmm.
whether you want to call it a defeat, the Taliban is in control of this territory.
Is Pakistan in civil war?
I guess, like, if we debated, you know, like we debated, you know, was Iraq in a civil war, probably there are conditions that would lead you to say yes, it is, and certainly what you're seeing in Pakistan is a situation in which the government has less and less control over its territory, and that's really the dangerous.
I would say one other thing, and I think it's something that sometimes gets missed. When you're talking about Pakistan, you're right. There's some pretty bad options. All the options that are being talked about right now are far more humane if Al Qaeda gets lucky in continental United States or a major mega attack in Europe. Then the options really do change, and that's going to be very, very difficult. I'm just saying, we're in a kind of weird interregnum right now, right? We're talking about drone attacks. We're talking about, you know, maybe some sort of, like, you know, local militias that we pay off and try to do things. You know, there's all kinds of things that are being talked about, a lot of them kinetic, a lot of them on the black side of things. And you're right, there are not a lot of very good options, but the discussion will radically change if Al Qaeda gets lucky again. Would you not agree with that?
I would agree with that.
And that radical
it also
change
depends.
Is not something that I'm not embracing that. I don't want to, but I'm saying if they get lucky again, you know, we're talking about daisy cutters, you know?
What's interesting also is that you have a kind of emerging split between the counterterrorism community and the counterinsurgency community over that, where more people on the counterterrorism side, particularly CIA in Pakistan, really does believe very strongly, and I'm not in a position to mm-hmm. adjudicate the merits of this, but, you know, it's been striking to me how uncaveated some of these assessments have been, that the drone attacks going on with Pakistani official, if not necessarily approval, you know, official, you know, looking the other way, have been really successful at taking out key leaders in Al-Qaeda and particularly increasingly the Pakistani Taliban, the Quetta Shura, which is basically the Afghan Taliban in exile. And the counterinsurgency community just looks on that as a looming disaster and fears really seriously how the drone attacks will basically just coalesce support behind an already, you know, intimidated and terrified population. My question for the Swat Valley that I can't answer, and I, you know, if it'd be possible to get over there, you know, maybe I'd get a better sense. But, you know, certainly it's not right now, or at least it's not right now for me, is to what degree the drone attacks, if they're hated more than the locals hate Al-Qaeda. There was an interesting poll that came out today in Pakistan. Bill Roggio linked to it, and that's how I saw it. That suggested that actually it's kind of the opposite. That certainly is the case that Pakistanis hate the drone attacks, but they hate Al-Qaeda more. They hate the Taliban more.
Was that an interesting item that Roggio wrote?
It was a great thing. What I wonder about, though, is to what degree we want to allow ourselves to believe that gives us some kind of cushion. You know, maybe it's the case that what this really should inform is a strategy whereby you just don't want to do anything to get in the way of that antipathy between the population and Al-Qaeda in Pakistan, and that might be the key to a greater strategy there. I'm curious about your thoughts on that.
There are fundamental disagreements, Spencer. I think that you think that our presence in these places could sort of refracts what should be the, you know, kind of opposition to Al-Qaeda, and that we sometimes can be a negative force in terms of diverting, you know, sort of the righteous anger of the population against these the terrorist groups. And my view is that sometimes our presence is necessary, like it was in 2006 and 2007 in Anbar, to protect and to support a local population that, you know, is, you know, in the process of sort of living under the boot of an Al-Qaeda or Taliban-like group. It's not an unsubtle, by the way, I want to say, this is not an either-or, people. It's true that the presence of foreign troops in a kind of intrusive way in the center of Baghdad was a factor that was used to generate sort of overall, or, you know, Al-Qaeda could use very successfully in a kind of propaganda campaign at times. But I think on the ground level, I think you also get a lot when you have American forces used correctly to protect the population, to employ some of these really important counterinsurgency strategies. I think that they do make a difference.
Well, except that these two situations aren't analogous for the very important reason that no one's talking about invading Pakistan. And you can't
unless Al-Qaeda gets lucky, and then people will start talking about invading Pakistan.
Perhaps, yeah. But the question of population-centric counterinsurgency, whereby the goal of the campaign is to protect the population and separate it from
but, you know, I'm just saying, Pakistan, though, is so diverse that if you're talking about trying to re-engage the Pakistani military, if that's possible, which we don't know, the ideal would be the Pakistani military would be competent and independent enough that they could pull these operations off. But, you know, Pakistan's a diverse place, so the military, which is largely, as I understand, the officer corps Punjabi, you know, would be seen in some ways as a foreign presence anyway. You know, the same dynamic in some ways would be there.
To some degree.
Yeah,
probably
to some degree.
Less than,
I mean,
than with us, I think it's fair to say. But also the thing that, you know, what it should look like is basically, you know, Afghanistan, you know, pre-9/11, that, you know, you've got probably like one series of options that isn't under contemplation that might make the greatest amount of difference, and everything else is about indirection, about making sure that, you know, local proxies are supported, and if there have to be, you know, boots on the ground less options, that they be used very sparingly and very precisely. And that's where the tension comes in between where, in fact, you know, sparingly is you know, defined. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's you know, something that I know the Obama administration is thinking about very deeply. And, I want to kind of end on this point and see, you know, what you make of it. You know, you had mentioned about how the right is, you know, just out of power, and, you know, it's not, I don't think you would go so far as to say it's irrelevant. But what I would be interested in seeing is, outside of a kind of emerging and coalescing debate on the left, what I'm not seeing is hardened ideological positions, you know, even hardened partisan positions on the question of Afghanistan. And I wonder,
on the right,
I mean, on the right and on the left, like, you wouldn't.
That's because it defies, I mean, there's no easy answer on it. And, you know, the Republican Party, if you go back longer than the last 8 years, or 9 years, I guess, you know, in the 90s, you know, Tom DeLay led the charge against the bombing of Kosovo and how it was a quagmire in the Balkans. I mean, you can go through the list, and the parties kind of flip on this question of internationalism depending on the circumstances. So there's a strain of the Republican Party that's been, you go back to Taft, to a degree Lindbergh.
But I think that might be a little bit orthogonal to this debate, because this isn't a question of an optional, attack.
Isn't that the argument, though, of the left who want to kind of get out, is that it is an optional thing? I mean, I'm not taking anything away from like a Glenn Greenwald, but I bet if you were to have him on the show, he would say, the threat of terrorism is completely overblown. What the hell are we doing there?
Well, what I would say, having talked to the Get Afghanistan Right people for a piece I did, that I think was the first piece written about them.
Yeah.
What they say is they make the counterproductivity argument. They say that ultimately, if you have, goals A through X for Afghanistan, first they would say, tell us what those are and then we'll evaluate them. Second, they'll say if you have them, what you've got to consider is the prospect of counterproductivity of American military action, particularly. One of the arguments made is that, as we put more troops into Afghanistan, we see how much worse it got, so you can't really draw that in. I don't personally find that a very compelling argument for a variety of reasons. It's less about troops than it is about strategy.
So you're an half-pack hawk.
If we have to say it, I guess. I mean, I don't really know what it is to be a hawk.
Especially growing wings and talons.
I just don't know what it is to be a hawk on these questions, because one of the things that you're probably going to see is a reduction in what the stated goals of this intervention is, of this war are.
Right.
And so, is that hawkish, is that dovish? I think it's kind of something.
But
that,
you favor is on the plus up. You favor.
I do believe that it is necessary. Yes.
You think it's necessary. Yes. The plus up is necessary. You also think that
it could also fail.
I mean, you are comfortable with the drone special ops, black ops stuff going on in Pakistan, which, if we were to put under a microscope, I bet I could get your Get Afghanistan coalition to probably not be comfortable with that,
Yeah, they definitely aren't, and I have more of a tolerance for it. I mean, just what I don't, I'll speak for myself, and then I'll speak for, the people I've talked to in the Obama administration. Just no one's confident about this. Like, no one's enthusiastic about any argument. No one is really saying, like you saw in Iraq, that positions are so hardened that you have to kind of defeat people talking point by talking point rhetorically. No one really believes that their preferred options are either good options or even have much confidence that they'll necessarily work. And this is going to be simultaneously a hard thing to, retain support for war on when you're saying, I don't really know if it's actually salvageable at this point. And
welcome
secondly,
to the club, Spencer. I'll get you a locker at Morton's and Dewey Claridge's home numbers.
Yeah. Well,
way to go, dude. Yeah.
Well, just also on that final question, I wonder if this is actually a situation where you could see, as a derivative, a kind of rejiggered American domestic foreign policy debate, which has more of a kind of mix of progressive and conservative positions about this particular intervention that coalesce.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think
John McCain basically supported it. AEI basically supported it. Yeah. I didn't really see much in the way of what was interesting about what I took away from the AEI panel last week was that they seemed to be trying to push Obama in a position that he was already going toward.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, listen, I can tell you that the sense of among people like sort of the defense hawks or the defense wonk types on the center right side of things, from what I've gathered in just my reporting, and I haven't been as closely monitoring as you are, is that they are very comfortable with Obama on Iraq and Afghanistan, and they are not comfortable with Obama on Iran. And that has been the consistent message I've gotten for the last 2 months, which is, we think Obama's going to do the right thing on Iraq and Afghanistan, he's probably not going to do the right thing on Iran.
And perhaps maybe we should leave it there and take this up some other time. With our neocon phenomenon, thank you very much.
Thank you,
from
Spencer,
the Washington Times.
A.K.A. the vitamin.
All right.
And what was your attackerman featuring the vitamin? We have to post that. We're going to get
Sang
to post
that. We'll bring that one back.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
All right, man.
Thanks.
See you.